This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to the second pilot episode of Cheerful Book Club. You're about to hear an interview that we did with Rennie Edo-Lodge, author of One, No Longer Talking to White People About Race. We think it's a fascinating book and a fascinating conversation. So here it is.
We'll talk about Rennie's book, which has done just tremendously well, Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race, which, I mean, the whole thing started as a blog post, and you write about this, and what the blog post was sort of you encountering so much defensiveness and denial about white privilege that you as an individual just thought, I'm exhausted by this. I can't have these conversations anymore. And I was wondering how much the book has shifted that, if you feel just the nature of that type of conversation has got better.
I do think that the type of person who I would have felt I was banging my head against a brick wall to attempt to try and convince that structural racism is an issue generally accepts that it is now, you know, and I hope that the book has been a part of that for many of those people. So, you know, that blog post that I wrote was after my time in the feminist movement, and I rushed into feminist activism at sort of like age 19 at university, you know, green-eyed? I'm trying to say naive,
you were
basically.
Green.
Not green-eyed, but anyway. Green, naive.
Wide-eyed.
Yes, wide-eyed, naive, excitable, and with this just general feeling that, like, all of the women in this movement who I was meeting, they were going to be, you know, allies for life, and we all got each other. And the further I got into the movement, I realised that that wasn't the case, and that an understanding of racism was a real barrier, actually, to solidarity and understanding between each other. And it was so disappointing, I think, to know white women in particular who were so sharp and analytical on gender inequality. But when you try to raise issues of race inequality with them, or even question some of the priorities of the broader feminist movement, which seem to be skewed towards the interests of white and middle-class women, when you tried to raise that, you were shut down and told that you were being divisive or a problem. And I think it was even more disappointing because, you know, as feminists who were also working inside a broader, like, progressive movement, like, you would get that same reaction from men when you said, oh, gosh, yeah, like, sexism is here, or these like, priorities and interests don't actually benefit women. Men would respond and be like, well, you're being divisive, you're being selfish, you're being this, that and the other. So it was so disappointing to see that reaction from white women.
How much of it do you think is people not wanting to look at darkness and in themselves and say, I'm thinking I'm not one of the bad ones. It can't be me. It's the other people who are the bad ones.
I think that's certainly the case, you know. And as I have been not just touring the book and speaking to readers, but also during my time as an activist, as a feminist activist and an anti-racism activist, like, I've had those moments of confronting my own, like, obliviousness myself. So I can understand the feeling. And I think that it's not necessarily a bad thing when you're confronted with obliviousness about, like, a systemic issue that never even affected you, so you didn't think about it. Like, that's not necessarily the bad thing. It's about, the bad thing is how you respond.
How, like, open you are to
the
it.
Next step. Like, are you going to believe people when they say, oh, like, this massive structural issue is affecting us negatively, and perhaps you may be implicated in it? Like, do you believe people, or do you say, actually, no, this is all in your head and you're bullying me, yeah, like, yeah, or you're being destructive to the movement and stuff?
Something that crops up a lot in the writing around the book and the reviews of the book is there's been a lot of this type of writing in the States, but less so in Britain. And I've heard you talk in interviews as well that in this country we can think, oh, it's, you know, they've got the real problem over there in the United States. Where do you think that comes from?
Well, I know that in my own personal experience, which I don't speak about at length in the book, but I do mention in the book that I found it strange, actually, to look back on my own experience of education. You know, I went to school in South London and then North London, that every Black History Month, the reference points were African American. So, like, the first, like, entry point of understanding what race inequality was and how racism affected people's lives was about African Americans. So that sets you up for thinking, okay, well, that's not really an issue here. But strangely, like, anecdotally, you know, in your communities around you, particularly when I was in Tottenham, because I moved to Tottenham when I was like 6 or 7, you'd hear people in the community speak about horrible injustices and vicious treatment, but what's the word? It wasn't canonized. It wasn't part of the country's understanding of itself. And that was a lot of what that first chapter was the book. Like, yeah, essentially just the amount of people have come to me and said, we knew all of this stuff happened, but this is like the first mainstream, like, representation of our lives during that period.
Well, I was thinking about this, and I don't know if it's the same for you, but you mentioned Black History Month, and it crops up in the book as well. It was founded in this country in the late 80s,
I think.
Yes. So in all the history I learned in school, and I'm sure it was the same for you, Ed, I don't remember learning any Black British history at all. There might have been a little bit about the civil rights movement in the States. Well,
I totally agree, and I thought one of the really striking things I learned about in the book was the Bristol bus boycott. I mean, we talk about Rosa Parks in school, but nobody talks about the Bristol bus boycott, do they? It's not like that's taught to people.
Well, with the exception of perhaps your listeners who literally live in Bristol, because
maybe you should say what happened in the Bristol.
Yeah,
there.
So I'm going to try and make a long story short. A man called Paul Stevenson essentially instigated a boycott against Bristol's buses in the late 60s because there was a colour bar. Like,
on him driving the buses?
Yes.
They refused to hire him as a driver because he was Black.
Well,
basically,
not him, but another. It was a young Jamaican man.
Right.
So he orchestrated a boycott because and sent somebody for a job interview just to test whether or not there was a colour bar, because lots of Black people in the city had applied to work on the buses and nobody ever got the job. So I think, like, he and some other activists called up to ask for a job interview, gave a name, and the bus company was like, yeah, there's vacancies. And as soon as the man turns up for the interview, they're like, oh, actually, sorry, no, it's position's been filled. So that was their evidence.
And they had a successful campaign against this colour bar.
And they got loads of people on board, and all the students, obviously, but also I think, like, the Jamaican High Commissioner, if I can remember correctly, although it's definitely more accurate in the book because it's been a while since I wrote it.
And the book, in that chapter of the book, there's a sort of whistle stop tour through Black history. Just, I mean, it gives an example. There are so many of these stories. I was wondering what it is like to be born in a country and not see yourself reflected in the history you're learning at school.
Confusing and frustrating, I think. You know, so the time when I started to really learn about what it meant to be a Black person who was born in Britain was when I was at university through a module that I had to choose to take, you know, and there was less than 20 of us in the class. My lecturer is always annoyed when I don't mention him. Alan Rice, shout out Alan Rice. He was the one who was teaching the module on the transatlantic slave trade at my alma mater. It just absolutely blew my mind. I was like, I mean, I hadn't thought that much about not knowing that history until I learned it. And then, you know, I went to uni in the Northwest. So we went to the International Slavery Museum in Liverpool and my mind was blown.
I was sort of very moved by what you said to your mum when you were four. I wonder if you can, which is in the book.
Yes.
Because I think it paints such a picture of the sort of hidden racism which a child sort of imbibes.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I was watching television and I was reading books and I was an avid reader. I was reading when I was like four. My mum loves to shout about that. And so I turned to her, having consumed all of this, or perhaps engaged with all of this culture, and said, well, when am I going to turn white? Because that's clearly like, I mean, obviously I didn't phrase it like this, but those are representations of humanity around me and I'm a human being and I'm like everybody else. So that's clearly going to happen for me at some point, you know? And she had to let me know that no, that was not going to happen.
And that was in the mid-1990s when you were four, correct?
Yeah.
Like everyone.
So quite recently our point of view.
But everyone you were seeing on TV as a kid, even then, you felt like if you saw somebody who looked like you, they were a baddie or they were a sassy sidekick.
Yeah, but they weren't the centre of the story. They weren't the person in the story from whom their eyes, like, we saw the world, you know?
Yeah.
So it's not like there weren't any, but they were sidelined.
Did you see any positive representation? If you think back, are there examples that really stand out to you?
I remember being excited by So Solid Crew in 2001.
Right.
I always talk about this. Well, not often, but I did a thing with the BBC recently where I was talking about it because it's like, wow, black British people on top of the pops.
Right.
You know, like that was exciting to me. So, yeah, there were people here and there, you know, potted about, perhaps the odd television kids TV presenter or something. I reached to America a lot.
Yeah. And just white very much seemed like the neutral or the default.
Yeah. There's a phrase from an African-American writer, a great, whose name escapes me, in which they say that, you know, you see yourself through the dominant culture's eyes. So, you know, you see yourself through that lens of difference.
And then you end up feeling like an extra or a side character then.
I don't know. I mean, when I think about how I felt during those times, I didn't feel particularly aggrieved, but I felt confused,
right.
You know, I felt confused.
You mentioned something that loomed very large as you were growing up, was the Stephen Lawrence case. Can you talk to me a little bit about that and the part it played, you know, in your childhood and teens?
Well, you know, when he was murdered, I was essentially a toddler living around the same area of London. And when two of the killers were convicted, I was in my early 20s. So in terms of like reporting on that case, it spanned a lot of like the formative years of my life. The bit that affected me the most was in 2012 when two of those killers were convicted. And it felt to me like a release, you know, like very overdue justice was being done. And then and this is when I was aggrieved, I was incensed, like raging at the fact that post the conviction of two of those killers, the sort of like news discussion shifted from that to Diane Abbott's racist against white people.
Can you remind people what
happened? So the journey was, there was lots of discussion about that. People were tweeting. This was the early days of Twitter. And there was a discussion about the writer Bim Adewumi said, I do wish everyone would stop saying the black community, though. Diane Abbott tweeted back to her. She said, white people love playing divide and rule. We should not play their game. Hashtag tactics as old as colonialism. I'm going to read from the book now. At this point, all hell broke loose. The news agenda swiftly changed. No longer were the newspaper editorials, radio packages and TV news people discussing Stephen Lawrence, the nuances of institutional racism or the realities and fears of growing up black in the UK. Now the news story was about racism against white people. Racism goes both ways, Abbott's detractors insisted. Writing in the Daily Telegraph, journalist Toby Young wrote, "Imagine the uproar if an equally prominent white conservative MP said something similar about black people on Twitter." Even Diane's Labour Party allies were defending her, couldn't help but describe her tone as robust and combative, as if their problem was with the tone of her tweet rather than the injustice it was confronting. And while Britain's white conservatives were insisting that this was reverse racism that was as unforgivable as murdering an unarmed black teenager, Britain's white liberals were terribly concerned that Abbott's harsh phrasing might undo all of her hard work, insisting that adding the word "some" to her tweet might have softened the impact of it.
So the murder of a black boy, which had taken, getting on for decades to secure a conviction, all of a sudden became about whether the language a black MP was using was appropriate.
Yeah, I was incensed by that. And at the time, I was a student union leader, and I was sat at my desk, and I couldn't concentrate. I was just fuming. And because I think that the conviction of those two men who had been walking free, just chilling, like for 20 years was so long overdue. And I really thought that it was going to provoke a conversation that I felt the country desperately needed.
Do you remember anything about that at the time, Ed?
About the Diane thing?
Yeah, you would have been leader at the time.
Yeah, and I think I sort of should confess, I think I played some role in Diane so making some apology for the remark.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Do you want to elaborate?
I suppose reading your book and sort of then rereading the context of the tweet, it gives a different perspective. I think the problem at the time was it seemed to be stereotyping sort of white people in general. But look, I sort of understand the point that you're making, that it's a sort of, you've got to understand the context in which she was saying it and the context of the situation.
Yeah, but I think also in terms of, let's say, what's worse, or like what's perhaps even more newsworthy, it felt very terrible that suddenly her tweet took up a lot of space and media attention when actually, in my opinion, something monumental had happened. And in comparison, her tweet wasn't monumental. Would I have tweeted it if I was an MP? Probably not. I would have said it around the pub table, though, I'm not going to lie. But I didn't. I think in comparison to the conviction of those murderers, it was literally not important.
I mean, I'm trying to think about what we learned about the, not so much about her tweet, but from the, you see, I think the context for people thinking about the conviction was good thing too. But it kind of reminds me of what you said. It makes me think of what you said earlier, which is, I guess the perspective that your book gives is when McPherson finds institutional racism in the police, it's almost like, I mean, it's a good thing that McPherson happened, obviously, but it's almost like it then confines it to the police. And I suppose what struck me earlier on is the gap between people thinking, well, institutional racism is something that happens over there, not over here. Do you know what I mean? So it's almost like the Stephen Lawrence thing was, it was sort of uncontroversial that it was good they were convicted, the police had been racist and all that, or relatively uncontroversial. But I suppose what you're saying is it should have provoked a broader discussion about not just sort of racism in the police, but racism everywhere.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com. Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I want to move on to something you talk about. So I do think, you know, people will grasp the idea of white privilege, but what you do in the book so well is spell out how that can affect a life. And you you give an example of a black boy going through life. I wondered if you could talk us through some of the obstacles that are faced that maybe people wouldn't sort of automatically be aware of.
Okay, so that part of the book where, you know, I come up with the idea of a hypothetical black boy, it was informed actually by my time working at the Runnymede Trust, because, you know, you're working at a race equality think tank, you're exposed to all this data all the time coming out from all sorts of different organisations that speaks to just drastic inequalities along racial lines in institutions that we expect to treat us fairly.
And you follow it from sort of cradle to grave, really.
I do indeed, yeah. And some of that data is going to be old now, you know. Some of it was old when I was writing the book, and I'm sure some of it's been refreshed at this point. So if there's ever a new edition of the book, I'll go off and do some updating. But you know, what I found, you know, when compiling this data was that, you know, in the school system, so something that really stuck out to me, and I can't remember the date of this report, but it was that in year six, so, you know, when the kids are doing their SATs, age 11, black children were routinely undermarked by their own teachers, and that was something that was remedied by anonymous marking.
So when the papers are then sent off, mm-hmm. and the people are divorced from knowing who the students are, the marks would go up, but their own teachers,
yeah.
People there with day in, day out, would mark them down.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I found in university, you know, the attainment gaps widely known now, that black students in particular were far less likely to get, you know, the highest marks in university compared to their white counterparts. And for me, I think one of the more galling things, because, you know, for a very long time before I was a jobbing journalist, I was a job seeker and I was never successful at it, was the Department of Work and Pensions, 2009, they did this big survey. And like I say, it's old, it's 10 years ago now, but I don't think anything's been done at the same scale. You know, they sent 2,000 CVs out to, you know, jobs in the public and private sector, some with British-sounding names, like white British-sounding names, some with African and Asian-sounding names. But the CVs had similar qualifications and experience, so they sent them out, got them back, you know, acceptances, rejections, and they found that if you had an African and Asian sounding name, you were far less likely to be called into a job interview than somebody with a white British sounding name, despite the similar qualifications and experience. So, you know, what I tried to do with some of that data was really be like, wow, disadvantage in schooling, like disadvantage in higher education, disadvantage when you're trying to apply for a job. And then later in the book, I speak about, I think, some research from the Trades Unions Congress that shows like literal pay inequality between white people, white British people, and people who are not white yet British, despite the higher qualifications. And for me, I think the point that I was trying to make when I was pulling that data together was that I actually don't think the teachers who are under marking black children, like, I don't think that they're fully paid up members of the BNP or, you know, whatever the far right party is today. I don't think that they think themselves as racist. I don't think that the people who are going through CVs, you know, in HR and the private and public sector, they're not saying I'm racist and proud. Yet the bias persists, right?
I mean, most people, I think, you know, at the level of conversation, you know, the simple anti-racist argument has been won. Most people aren't walking around thinking of themselves as racist, but as white people are carrying white privilege. So how do you start to fix that? Is it at an individual level by hearing stories in the way we do in your book and hearing about your experience? Or does it need to be something that is done top down as a society or some combination of both?
I think that the solutions come from all places. So obviously, as an author and as somebody who's active in the cultural sphere, I'm very, very into changing hearts and minds. And, you know, in my opinion, top-down approaches, which, you know, I think are like objectively good, can provoke resentment in people who don't understand why they're happening in the first place. And so I think my job as an author is to win hearts and minds, so that when that top-down work, like, for example, positive discrimination happens, people are like, well, I'm on board with that because I understand the point of it, you know?
Because it's something you've come around, as a teenager, it was something that you were unconvinced of, and it's something you've come around to as you got older.
I mean, but when I was a teenager, like, I take into account my background, you know, I grew up in Tottenham. I went to school in Haringey. Like, I lived a super multicultural, like, mixed communities areas of Britain. So the idea and pretty working class as well. Like, I wasn't exposed to people like much more advantaged than me until I started to try and like graduate and get out into the job market. So I didn't actually understand what the problem looked like. So, you know, when, you know, and I write about this in the book, when my mum suggested that I apply for a positive action scheme at a newspaper, I was shocked. I was like, but why should I, like, this is special treatment. That's until I got to the offices and I was like, oh, okay, this is not like the environment that I'm going to school in or the streets that I'm walking in Tottenham. This is a very different environment indeed. And I realised what the point of it was.
There's some, just to come back to something you mentioned there, you write later in the book about intersectionality and gender and class. How do you think that sort of plays into this wider conversation?
I think that I tried my absolute hardest in the book to really demonstrate how, so for example, when we're talking about racism, well, the majority of black people in this country are working class. So it's not just as, you know, a isolated conversation to wealth inequality. Do you know what I mean? Like, when I think about who comes to my house to deliver me Uber Eats, or who's picking me up in an Uber, or delivering me food on Deliveroo or a pizza or something, like, it's the kind, it's people who, like, I lived around when I was living in Tottenham and to some extent where I live now. So, and those issues of things like, you know, the gig economy and, you know, 0-hour contracts, to me, that seems very much tied into, like, broader issues to do with, like, wealth inequality, racism, you know, precarious work, all of that stuff. And I feel I tried my hardest in the book to demonstrate that. But I think in the broader public conversation, these things aren't always linked together. And what I'm talking about there is intersectionality, right? So it's not sufficient to talk about class over there and race over there. And I think that sometimes the dividing of these issues is what's allowed a sort of like pernicious narrative of the white working class that really like pits people who really don't have much first place against each other.
See, I think maybe the issue about sort of white privilege is that there are lots of white people who feel very unprivileged. You know what I mean? Some people might say, I'm not saying whether I agree with this or not, I'm not sure, that I think the book is incredibly compelling. So this is sort of not to in any way diminish that. I think maybe there's an issue about talking about white people in general without sort of narrating that there's like white people who are like, you know, super rich and doing incredibly well and benefiting from great things. And then there are white people who are like really got massive barriers themselves.
Which is where the intersectionality comes in. Yes. But then that's a separate thing to some of the other stuff you write about just sort of walking round and feeling other or being other.
Yes. Well,
you know, those white people who had nothing, I grew up next door to them, like, or in the council flat that I spent like the first 6 years of my life in. Like, I grew up next door to them and felt a strong affinity until the far right came in and said to people like, you know, I can remember when I was 6 years old, my best friend was this little white boy called Callum, and we went around everywhere in South London. And the far right came in and they told people like Callum and his mum that they had more of a right to the resources of this country than me and my mum because they were white.
Or worse, that their problems were being caused by people like you and your, you know what I mean?
And we were both two kids with single mums, you know, growing up in South London. So for me, I actually don't think that the work that I'm doing is trying to negate the hardship that he and his mum were dealing with, but rather to illuminate that. And objectively, I don't know how Callum's doing now, but me personally, I'm doing well. Like, my book's done well. Like, I've moved class. Like, I'm living a comfortable life. And that's something that I continue to attempt to recognize. And I don't wish to advance a narrative of I'm struggling simply because I'm black. Like, yes, everyday racism still happens to me. But frankly, I'm fine.
There's a really good interview in the book. One of the bits that stood out for me was an interview with a mixed race girl, which kind of speaks to this, I think, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, what I was saying is white privilege is an advantage. It doesn't negate class discrimination. It doesn't negate gender discrimination, but rather it's the gross racial disparities in things that DWP study that I speak of means that there are still some discriminations and stereotypes that are putting barriers in the face of people who frankly don't deserve it for largely arbitrary reasons that have everything to do with a sense of systemic racism. And that's not me saying that white people who are working class don't deal with class discrimination.
You deal with this a bit in the book, and maybe it's a sort of slightly stupid question, but what do you think white people should be doing?
Well, I think that, and like I say, it's been 2 years since the book came out, so I've had a lot of time to reflect. And something that I have, a conclusion that I've drawn is that the book is it's an analysis, and it exists to be applied, right? Like, for me, anti-racism is something that needs to be applied in whatever sphere or field that you're in. So just like an analysis of gender discrimination, once you have the tools to make it, then you can start to see in your own life, in your own spheres of influence, I see what that is. And I think that I can change that situation, you know. How? I don't wish to say, but really what I wanted the book to do, and you know, I even say towards the end of the preface, I hope you use this as a tool, was to essentially provide people with the tools to make that analysis. It's so strange because in writing, and you know, I think you can tell I'm a writer, I love to write alone, and I didn't really think that I was going to be speaking for anybody or on behalf of anyone, and you know, that's why I've never been great. When I was in student politics and people were sort of pushing me to actually go into actual politics, I was like, no, thank you. I just need to be speaking on behalf of myself. So
you made a wise choice, I'd say, based on my experience.
It's been really mind-blowing to me when people come up to me and they say, you've spoken for me, you know, I feel heard by your work. I didn't anticipate that. And it's happened in Britain and outside of Britain. And so that's something that consistently, I suppose, shocks me. For me, I think the more distance I have from the book, the more I can think about that sense of just feeling so unheard. Like, I felt so unheard, so frustrated every time I turned on the news, and I was like, this is not the right angle. Like, you're missing something. I felt like that all the time. That sense of urgency, I think, you know, found its way into the book, and I hear from readers, they have caught that urgency, and I'm like, oh, sorry, I didn't realise it was that contagious, right? So that, you know, that really blows my mind.
What's next? Is it a secret?
Well, I haven't signed on the dotted line for whatever's next. I'm thinking about things. I'm doing a lot of reading, and I've also been touring the book a lot because it's out in about 5 or 6 languages, a lot in Europe. I've been blown away by the people who've reached out to me from around the world and said, this same power structure, this same system of domination is prevalent in my country. And that's made me feel, that's given me a sense of perspective. It's made me feel a sense of affinity and I suppose a shared experience with people who are navigating the similar structures, because colonialism, you know, really was a global project. I've just done so much learning since the book came out, and I feel I'm a better person for it. It's made me, the sense of perspective it's given me has been incredible. And I think whatever comes next, whether that be a book, I suppose if people want a book from me, it's going to be informed by that. I've also sort of come away with a sense of solidified understanding of the point of this book. And I think everybody who's read that opening blog post can feel the sense of despair and pessimism that was in it, and a sense of essentially just giving up. You know, I really did give up. And the shift that I think that the book has made in a lot of people's minds really does confirm to me that what I was talking about in that book is an ideology. Much like Noam Chomsky, like, talks about capitalism, and he speaks about the ideology, and he wants you to see what it looks like. And reading some of his work made me think, oh God, okay, I never really thought about it like that. Readers who've come back to me and said that they now see what that ideology looks like and how it's harming people, like, it just confirms to me that it's learned and it can be unlearned. That's been a sort of like profound and largely positive learning experience as well. So whatever comes next is going to be informed by all of the learning that I've done in the last couple of years.
Well, I was going to finish by asking you to give us something to be cheerful about, but I think you've just kind of done that.
Yeah,
by describing your experience.
I think it's really important because, you know, we're in a time now where people are pointing out social injustice here, there and everywhere, and we're all pretty angry and annoyed and upset about it for obvious reasons. But I kind of feel like we can go either one or two ways. We can be like, well, it's just innate and like take a route that some people who fancy themselves as sociobiologists, so, oh, this is just how people are, this is just it. Or we can be like, actually, it can be shifted, you know, like, for me, the question is now, what do we do with this acknowledgement? Ultimately, I really do not want to be dealing with the same types of frustrations that I had in 50 years' time. If the Earth is still here, of course.
That's a whole other depressing conversation, isn't it? Rennie, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot.
Our thanks to Rennie Edo Lodge, and we would love to hear from you. What do you think of Cheerful Book Club? What could we be doing more of? What would you like to hear us include when we launch it into a podcast proper? You can email us, bookclub@cheerfulpodcast.com. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/reasons to be cheerful podcast, or find us on Twitter @cheerfulpodcast.